This is Naomi Ruth Lewinsky, December 4th, 1998. The Language of Soul, Psychotherapy as Poetic Form.
Analyst at the C.G. Jung Institute of San Francisco, and she took her training at that institute. She taught for many years at Pacifica in the Depth Psychology program. She is a published poet and author of the book The Mother Line, Every Woman's Journey to Find Her Female Roots. She's poetry and fiction editor of Psychological Perspectives. She speaks and publishes widely on the feminine and the creative. Her most recent publication was a poem in the Autumn 98 issue of the Crab Creek Review, and that is a literary magazine that's published here in Seattle. Naomi has found inspiration in the writings of H.D., and that is Hilda Doolittle, an American poet who underwent an analysis with Sigmund Freud. Naomi assures me that what H.D. had was an archetypal analysis. It was a Jungian analysis performed by Freud. Naomi's essay on H.D. can be found in the Fall 97 issue of the San Francisco Jung Institute Library Journal. And please join me in welcoming Naomi Lewinsky.
Thank you, Karen. Need to have mobility. I'm here to speak to you this evening at the request of the poet in me. She heard I was to give a talk for the Jung Society of Seattle. "I want that talk," she announces. "I like Seattle. It's a poetic town. And I just had a poem published in the Seattle Poetry Magazine, Crab Creek Review." "Wait a minute," I say. "I don't think that's really appropriate. The Jungians of Seattle have invited me as a Jungian analyst, not as a poet." She then proceeds to tell me that psychotherapy, especially the Jungian-oriented sort, is a poetic form. Jungians love all the stuff of poetry, myth, metaphor, depth. She argues that both the poet and the psychotherapist are working with language, that the medium of psyche's exchange in the consulting room, as well as in the poem, is word, affect, and image, that the language in the therapy hour, like in the poem, must be alive, charged with meaning. She complains about jargon, how it deadens the tongue. When the word and the image are alive in the room and you feel its emotion, then you know something is happening in the therapy. At first, I resist her. She is so pushy. "The work of a poet is to create a poem," I say. "Surely you are not saying that the psychotherapist should see her patient as a work of art." "Of course not," she says. "Don't be so concrete. It's more that the patient and the psychotherapist are two aspects of the creative process, engaged in a dialogue to release the patient's poetic voice, her capacity to say her deepest meaning in words. Instead of that critical voice, the judge, that stops so much creative flow, the psychotherapist provides a supportive, reflective voice, a voice that opens doors to the unconscious realms, that provides a context, a hold, a feeling in the room that allows the creative to emerge. "But why," I say, "do you call psychotherapy a poetic form, like a sonnet or an elegy?" "Psychotherapy is a form. It's got a rhythm, weekly, twice a week, three times a week. It is a container, literally an hour in time, a room in space. Jung calls it a temenos, a sacred space. Poetry simply means something made. All I mean is that psychotherapy is something made in words and images in this temenos." "Well," I say, "what about regressive work? What about when people enter young states of consciousness in therapy? Now I think I've got her, but I haven't. She says, that needs to be heard poetically too. The baby is a poet, and she pulls out a book of essays by a leading poet, Donald Hall, who calls his book Death to the Death of Poetry. Hall has had a Freudian analysis and has developed a libidinal theory of poetry. And I'm quoting here from Hall. Freud said he would not discuss the provenance of literary form, but that he believed it was related to forepleasure. The remark is mysterious, but I believe its suggestion correct. Poetry is more erotic than prose, and its eroticism begins long before we approach a poem's statement. If it is beautiful poetry, when we read it or hear it, our skin tingles and our eyes glisten. We are aroused. When my children were teeny, I loved the sounds they made in their cribs, happy in the morning. This cooing is autistic utterance, and it is the beginning of poetry. Pleasure in the mouth, lips and tongue rubbing together to make sound without meaning. While the mouth nibbles on noises, the same infant pulses its limbs sensuously and rhythmically. Here is the beginning of delight in sensuous sound. Before words come, here is the beginning of poetry. If crib pleasure does not endure, there will be no poetry. And just in case, I think she's understanding the creative libido only in Freudian terms, she reaches for Jung's essay on psychology and literature and reads what he said about the poet. And this is Jung. The primordial experience is the source of his creativeness. In itself, it is wordless and imageless, for it is a vision seen as in a glass, darkly. It is nothing but a tremendous intuition striving for expression. It is like a whirlwind that seizes everything within reach and assumes visible form as it swirls upward. Since the expressions can never match the richness of the vision and can never exhaust its possibilities, the poet must have at his disposal a huge store of material if he is to communicate even a fraction of what he has glimpsed, and must make use of difficult and contradictory images in order to express the strange paradoxes of his vision. She's trying to pull me off my focus on clinical work, but I'm on to her. So, what does this have to do with psychotherapy? That is what we were talking about. Everything, she answers. The patient is like the poet in Jung's description, in the grip of primordial experience, struggling to find expression for the richness of an inner vision. It is the work of the therapist to support that process, to put your ear to the deepest ground of your patient's feeling and listen for the word that comes from the soul, the image that rings with the truth. Then, when you feed it back, you are offering soul food. She is very convincing, don't you think? And she does do her homework. Perhaps I should give you a little history of our relationship. In the beginning of my life, she was ascendant in my nature. She figured I would devote my life to her, which was, she was convinced, her due. It hasn't worked out that way, and that has been the cause of our lifelong argument. She has had to take the back seat for most of my life to make room for more pragmatic devotions such as family, friends, and the practice of Jungian analysis. I've told her time and again that I've done it all for her. After all, I said, how do you propose to make a living as a poet? That argument does not impress her. After a few years spent in a major pout, she has been staging her comeback, guerrilla warrior style, infiltrating the landscape of my consciousness, raiding my time and attention, stealing my thunder. She has inserted herself into everything I do. In every aspect of my life, I hear her voice giving me her rendition of my experience. She wants to slow everything down, to get to the heart of every feeling, the meaning under the meaning, the image within the word, the light in the dark, and the dark in the light. She announced that it wasn't enough that I listened to her comments and what I did. She wanted time of her own, time for her work. I said I didn't have that kind of time. When I put time in her hands, she takes forever, dreaming, dawdling, working for hours on a single line. That was when she began intruding on my personal life. She began invading the vacations I took with my husband, Dan, putting me into a trance state, which she calls poetry head. Dan could barely get a conversation with me. So much was I being called inward to listen to her. She'd squeeze at least one poem out of every trip. I began to see that it wasn't working to keep her out of my everyday life. I had to invite her in, or she would do considerable damage. So I made a deal with her. I told her that if she would help me out in my practice, I would give her time for herself alone. We'd write together, we'd read together. Actually, I was surprised at how helpful she was in my analytic work. She put her ear to the ground of my patients' language, helped me hear their crib pleasure or their dark intuitions reaching for visible form. I find that her impulse to get to the bottom of an image, a feeling, a presence in the room, to give voice to its deepest nature, supports my therapeutic concerns. So I've learned to listen to her in my consulting room. You'd think she'd feel valued, but it's not enough for her. She wants more of my life. Truth be told, she's become a backseat driver. When I was asked some time ago to teach Jungian-based psychotherapy at Pacifica, she began whispering in my ear about Jung and poetry. Give me a break, I said. Jung and poetry? I'm just trying to get basic Jungian concepts across. My point exactly, she said. Poetry's your best vehicle. Take, for example, Rainer Maria Rilke, the greatest 20th century poet in the German language, perhaps in any language, born the same year as Jung. Who better to introduce your students to the collective unconscious? He writes straight out of it. Jung knew that, writing in a letter that Rilke drew from the same deep springs as I did. Rilke, like Jung, made the deep plunge inward to find his way back out into the universal. Both men were pulled into their life's trajectory by a powerfully introverted libido. Listen to Rilke's description of this in his third Duino elegy. How he was caught up and entangled in the spreading tendrils of inner event, already twined into patterns, into strangling undergrowth, prowling bestial shapes. How he submitted, loved his interior world, his interior wilderness, that primal forest inside him, where among decayed tree trunks his heart stood, light green, loved, left it, went through his own roots and out into the powerful source where his little birth had already been outlived. Doesn't that describe Jung's whole enterprise? But Jung's most powerful influence was another poet, an earlier one, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. When Jung, in his troubled youth, was wrestling with his experience of the living God and feeling painfully alienated from the dead religion and empty symbolism which his father and his uncles, who were all pastors, preached, he found a mentor and an ancestor in Goethe. There was a family legend that Jung's grandfather was an illegitimate son of Goethe's. Whatever the truth of this story, Jung was certainly Goethe's spiritual descendant. When he first read Faust, he no longer felt, quote, isolated, a sport of cruel nature, unquote, he writes in his autobiography. My godfather and authority was the great Goethe himself. So, the poet in me announces, the most powerful way to illuminate Jung's basic concepts would be to teach from Goethe's Faust. Goethe's Faust, I say. I've never even read it. They say it's impossible to understand, especially part two. That's because part two is the unconscious, she says. It's like a great big dream. The beginning and basic outline of all Jungian psychology is in Faust. That's what Jung himself says. In Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, he summarizes his psychology in his description of his response to Faust. Faust struck a chord in me and pierced me through in a way that I could not but regard as personal. Most of all, it awakened in me the problem of opposites, of good and evil, of mind and matter, of light and darkness. Faust, the inept, purblind philosopher, encounters the dark side of his being, his sinister shadow, Mephistopheles, who in spite of his negating disposition represents the true spirit of life as against the arid scholar who hovers on the brink of suicide. All right, I say, I'll try Goethe. And I found she was right. In fact, I got quite possessed by Faust, which anybody who knew me at Pacifica can attest to, which ranges over 3,000 years of Western culture and is a drama in which the archetypal themes of analysis play themselves out. Faust is a dried-up academic in a midlife crisis when he starts hanging out with the devil, all kinds of libido lets loose. He gets a good Christian girl in trouble. He dances with witches. In a dream, he falls in love with the classical soul figure, Helen. He has to make a terrifying journey into the underworld, which Goethe calls the realm of the mothers. So I said to the poet in me, thank you for Faust. That really is a gift. Thank you for helping me in my practice. That too is a gift. Thank you for changing my life, deepening my everyday experience, helping me feel more fully myself. You're welcome, says she. But there's something else I want, something you still owe me. You want more? I've let you backseat drive my teaching, sneak into my practice, get between my husband and me. Isn't that enough? You're like the fisherman's wife in the fairy tale. Whenever the fish gives the husband a gift, a thank you for saving his life, a bigger house, a kingdom, his wife sends him back for more. What more do you want? My soul? Get off it, she says. I am your soul, and you know it. I want a legitimate place in your life. If I had real time and attention, a real voice in your calling, I wouldn't have to be so sneaky. I wouldn't have to push my way in where I'm not wanted. Wait a minute, I say. You have the most legitimate place I can offer you in my practice. Don't I listen to you? Don't I respect what you say? You do. But that's a favor I do for you. It's payback time. I'm tired of being an advisor and a consultant, tired of having authority only in your private life. I want to be the one in the driver's seat. She's getting shrill, don't you think? Give some parts of yourself an inch and they take a mile. I don't understand what more you could want of me. I've given you time. We write together every morning. We read poetry. We subscribe to poetry magazines. What more do you want? It's very simple. I want to give your Seattle Jung Society talk in my own voice, not yours. I want to come out of the closet. I want to be taken seriously. What if you embarrass me? What if I do? You embarrass me all the time. I'll make you a deal. Let me give this talk, and you can edit it. And that is how it happened that I turned this talk over to the poet in me. Though that was hardly what you'd call a generous introduction, I am glad to be let out to speak with you this evening. I am the poet, the thief of time and energy, the secret ear to the ground. I could complain to you about how I've been denied and devalued, and then you'd all be sitting here feeling as though you've landed in some internal couples therapy session in which two aspects of psyche are learning to fight fairly. You may wonder who we are to one another, we two parts of this one person talking to ourselves in public. I see it this way. She is what Jung calls the number one aspect of the personality, the ego who cares about making a living and feeding the family. I am number two, her soul, her deepest self. She belongs to this time, this profession. I belong to all time. She is the above ground sister. I am the below ground sister. She sees outwardly I see inwardly. She doesn't realize it, my daylight other, but I'm grateful for her green growth in the practical air, her roots in a particular time and place, the sunshine and rain realities of work and relationship. They feed us both. Jung wrote of the poet, in this case Rilke, that he doesn't have what it takes to make a man complete, body, weight, shadow. Without my above-ground sister, I would not have the body, weight, and shadow to make me complete. I would be insubstantial. As they say nowadays, I wouldn't have a life. But my above-ground sister needs me to make her life complete as well. She needs me to remind her that poetry is psyche's native tongue. It is the way people have always told the deeper story, the story that flows under all the others, the night story, the birth story, the death story, the love story, the story of the gods and the ancestors. There was a time when words were magic, when metaphor and myth were living presences, when soul was not inside us, but all around us in the living world. A tree had its own spirit. A rock was the form of a god. A metaphor was a way of carrying sacred meaning from the realm of the gods to the human imagination. Let me give you a metaphor. Poetry and psychology are the fruits of the same world tree. This tree has its roots in the underworld, where dead souls wander and dark gods reign. Its branches reach up into the realm of flight, into spiritual imagination. Its fruits offer those who taste them what the Hindus call the rasas of life, life's juices, life's essential emotions. Long before psychology became its own branch of the world tree, poetry was the medium through which psyche knew herself, felt herself, tasted the fruit of the tree. Poetry began in our ancestral need to talk to the gods, to invoke, to chant, to pray, to use the human voice to make a bridge between the inner and the outer realms. The poem appears in the heart at a time when the fire has been lit, when the blood of the mother has been wiped off the newborn baby's face, and when the ancestors appear in the dead of the night. It finds its passionate way through the throat to the tongue, and in the heat of feeling, an image forms, and the words arise to give it voice. The boundary between life and death is crossed. The unutterable is uttered, enabling a mystery to be experienced. Listen. Alleluia, light burst from your untouched womb like a flower on the father side of death. The world tree is blossoming. Two realms become one. This is Hildegard von Bingen's 12th century Alleluia verse for the Virgin. On the other side of the world, in India, several centuries later, Lal Ded, who left her neglectful husband and harsh mother-in-law to become a disciple in a cult of Shiva worship, wrote, "The soul, like the moon, is new and always new again, and I have seen the ocean continuously creating. Since I scoured my mind and my body, I too, Lala, am new, every moment new. My teacher told me one thing, live in the soul. When that was so, I began to go naked and dance." Jung too says, live in the soul. He is speaking of the creative imagination. He says it is the only primordial phenomenon accessible to us, the real ground of the psyche. Therefore I speak, Jung says, of esse in anima, which means live in the soul. He quotes the 19th century German playwright Gerhard Hauptmann, who says that poetry is the art of letting the primordial word resound through the common word. One could say that a depth-oriented psychotherapy is that too, the art of letting the primordial word resound through the common word. Indeed, it can be argued that one symptom of a psychological problem is a problem with language, an inability to find the words, the images, to express oneself deeply and to engage other people's feelings. When a person first comes to therapy, often he is depressed. He has lost his way in life. His life does not feel like his own. Even his voice does not feel like his. When you listen to such a person, you hear him constantly undercutting his own meanings, like a critical parent whose child can do nothing right. Listen to someone who's really depressed. Every sentence turns on itself, undercuts itself. Often his very voice is flat and dull, lacks resonance, as though he doesn't believe in anything he says. He doesn't seem to care about his own pain. He is corrosive to himself. He certainly can't compel your attention, which is exactly what he needs, the kind of attention that hears the deeper meaning of what he says, that hears the underlying rage or grief or fear or blocked creativity. He is like the garden the poet H.D. describes in a section of a poem she wrote in a time of terrible alienation from herself. In my garden, the winds have beaten the ripe lilies. In my garden, the salt has wilted the first flakes of young narcissus and the lesser hyacinth, and the salt has crept under the leaves of the white hyacinth. In my garden, even the wind flowers lie flat, broken by the wind at last. Most of us know this garden. Most of us have been in such a place, our fecundity eaten by salt, our flowers broken by the wind. What can grow in such a garden? Synchronistically, while I was working on this paper, my husband Dan and I took a vacation on an island where the winds beat the flowers and salt creeps onto the leaves near the shore. This is the Big Island of Hawaii. Much of the island is made up of great expanses of black lava churned up by the volcano that created the island. But there are flowers growing wild and flowers growing in beautifully tended gardens. How can that be? There were ancestral plants, I learned, which were able to cross at least 2,000 miles of ocean. Some had spores or seeds light enough to be carried by the wind. Others had seeds which could float on water. Still others were carried by birds or by the Polynesians who came to the Hawaiian Islands 2,000 years ago. Some of these have proved hardy enough to tolerate the winds and the salt. What does this have to do with our depressed patient and the broken flowers of HD's island garden? Maybe lilies, narcissus, and white hyacinths are the wrong flowers to grow here. Maybe our depressed patient thought the only flowers worth growing were lilies and narcissus, or his mother had a passion for the white hyacinth. There will be grief and suffering in giving up the idea of the kind of garden he thought he should have. Maybe it's the work of psychotherapy to wait patiently on the blasted, salt-eaten ground to see what spore the wind will bring. What bird will appear with what seed? What will be washed up by the sea waters that can take root and grow? What words can bring life back to his language? And as the garden flourishes, so does our patient's language. The poet Denise Levertov describes language as a form of life and a common resource to be cherished and served as we should serve and cherish earth and its water, animal and vegetable life, and each other. If our language is not alive, we are out of touch with one of the basic experiences of being human. It is though we have lost touch with the divine. In the Gospel of St. John, it is said, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us." What beautiful, mysterious words. What can it mean to say that the Word is God? Etymologically, word and breath have similar roots. In the Hebrew Bible, God is breath, spirit, inspiration. When breath becomes word, we transcend our bounded being and enter a world that joins us. You hearing my words, join me in some middle realm between our separateness. That is why it is such a magic moment when a baby says his first word, Mama. His mother is entranced, enchanted. He's certainly been able to get her attention before, crying, cooing, but this is different. His tongue has a name to call her, a recognition at once of their connection and their difference. Imagine when human beings first spoke, first invoked the gods as the ancient poems do. We invoke something larger than ourselves. We see that there is something larger than ourselves at work. When God is dead, the word is dead. If we understand God in the way Jung does, as the unconscious, the libido, then to renew our connection to the word is to renew our connection to God. Uh-oh, I'm feeling my above-ground sister hovering. Am I about to be edited? Well, you're so devotional in your tone, so religious. It's a little embarrassing to hear you go on and on like that. Most people think of psychology as a science, not an art or a religion. Jung certainly always claimed to be an empiricist. Well, that's true, and there are many ways of knowing, and science is certainly a good one. But unless psychology remembers its roots in poetry, it risks the danger that Jung was worried about, a world with the gods drained out of it and with magic exiled to the children's nursery. Psychology wants to be seen as a science because in our culture, only the sciences are seen as being true, meaning serious and grown up. But poetry, as the critic Bruce Murphy wrote recently, that supposedly marginal art, has an uncanny way of finding the center of the contemporary conscious. In fact, I would argue that the whole 20th century enterprise of bringing inspiration, breath, back, and myth back to poetry via H.D. and Ezra Pound has been about returning the gods to our language. You're hovering again. More editorial commentary? Aren't you going pretty far afield here? This is not supposed to be a lecture on 20th century poetry. It's a lecture on Jungian psychology. I've got an idea. How about I present a case? Isn't that what you do in your field, present cases? Well, it is what we do, mostly in teaching situations. It's pretty dicey, though, because the container of analysis is a confidential one, and I'm not one who likes to open it lightly. I've got the perfect case, then. The case of a great dead poet in analysis with a great dead analyst. The poet is H.D., Hilda Doolittle. She was a contemporary of Ezra Pound and D.H. Lawrence, famous for her early imagist poems. Analysis saved her, both personally and as a poet. After her analysis, she went on to write some of the greatest poems of this century, Trilogy, Helen in Egypt, and Hermetic Definition. Her analyst was Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud? Wait a little minute. This is a talk sponsored by the C.G. Jung Society. Why should we hear a case example of an analysis by Freud? First of all, from my vantage point, which is the long view, much too much is made of the difference between Freud and Jung. Their followers have divided the world up between them too neatly. Freud equals personal unconscious, Jung equals collective unconscious. In the big picture, Freud and Jung have much more in common than not. They are both engaged in this vast enterprise of bringing the psychological attitude to consciousness. I know you do basic Freudian work about your patients' personal childhoods in your practice every day. And the Freud H.D. describes in her memoir, Tribute to Freud, and in her long poem, The Master, can be surprisingly Jungian. He introduced this Freud, introduced H.D. to her to his gods, encouraged her to study the religion of her forebears, helped her find her way through the tangled web of her family complexes back to her center, her creative source. In her poem, The Master, H.D. writes of her work with Freud that, quote, we wrote philosophy on the dream content, for God is all, and the dream is God. How Jungian can you get? It was Freud who helped her understand God's plan for her, that she was a poet, that she had to suffer the prophetic visions that came through her. It was Freud whom she internalized as the wise old man, the alchemist, the magus, who continued to guide her for many years after she stopped seeing him in analysis. Secondly, H.D.'s work is profoundly Jungian, mythic, hermetic, alchemical, psychological in the deepest and widest sense. Hers is a poetry that laments the loss of the gods. Listen, they have banished the gods and the half-gods from the city's streets. They have turned from the god of the crossroads, the god of the hearth, the god of the sunken well and the fountain source. Hers is a poetry of the archetypal moment as it pierces the personal, the human, the mortal experience. Dip into the pages of her collected poems, and you dip into the living myth. She brings the gods back into our language. You feel the burning moment as the god sears the flesh of personal experience. Hers is a poetry that is an enchantment, an actual magical or alchemical process. H.D. knew the work of the alchemists. She knew the Kabbalah. She was involved in occult practices. Listen. Now polish the crucible, and in the bowl distill a word most bitter, Mara. A word bitterer still, Mar. Sea, brine, breaker, seducer, giver of life, giver of tears, now polish the crucible and set the jet of flame under until Mara, Mar are melted, fuse and join, and change and alter, Mare, 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 Mater, Maya, Mary, Star of the Sea, Mother. What has happened here? An alchemical process has been performed on a word. A crucible has been polished. A flame has been lit. A bitter word, Mara, has been distilled and transformed into Mare, meaning the sea, Mare, the French mother, Mare, Mater, Maya, Mary, star of the sea, mother. Mother has been derived from the sea. I think she was able to do this because of her work with Freud. In fact, it is a very condensed description of her work with him. In her lovely memoir, Tribute to Freud, we get a glimpse into the creative dialogue between H.D. and Freud in the service of her soul. She writes that when she goes to see him for the first time in Vienna, what she notices are his gods. I was to greet the old man of the sea, but no one had told me of the treasures he had salvaged from the sea depth. Freud tells her that she is the only person who has ever come into this room and looked at the things before looking at me. Freud's things are his collection of ancient deities. He does not just collect them, he relates to them. Once he hands a figure of Osiris to H.D. and tells her that he is the answerer. He has Greek gods, Egyptian gods, Indian gods. H.D. has a running joke about them in her tribute. In 1938, Freud flees the Nazis and comes to London, where H.D. is living. Her analysis with him has been over for a few years, though she and Freud continue to correspond. There is concern among Freud's friends about the fate of his treasures, which are eventually smuggled to safety. H.D., who remembers that gardenias are Freud's favorite flower, searches all over London to find some for him. She sends them with an unsigned note, quote, to greet the return of the gods. Freud writes her the following note. Dear H.D., I got today some flowers. By chance or intention, they are my favorite flowers, those I most admire. Some words to greet the return of the gods. Other people read goods. No name. I suspect you to be responsible for the gift. If I have guessed right, don't answer, but accept my hearty thanks for so charming a gesture. In the play on words, gods, which some call goods, which dances through the pages of H.D.'s Tribute to Freud, we catch a glimpse of one of the paradoxical treasures of their work together. H.D. touched on that part of Freud's soul which responded to the gods, which he usually thought of as goods. She describes a transference and an analysis which is archetypal as well as personal. However, it is clear to H.D. that Freud has no use for the occult, that he, quote, would turn the whole stream of consciousness back into useful, into irrigation channels. Though she has a big transference to him, she knows that, quote, the professor is not always right. He did not know, or did he, that I looked at the things in his room before I looked at him. For I knew the things in his room were symbols of eternity and contained him then as eternity contains him now. She gives us a wonderful portrait of him. He will sit there quietly like an old owl in a tree. He will say nothing at all, or he will lean forward and talk about something that is actually apparently unrelated to the progression or unfolding of our actual dream content or thought association. He will shoot out an arm, sometimes somewhat alarmingly, to stress a point. Or he will, always making an occasion of it, get up and say, ah, now we must celebrate this, and proceed to the elaborate ritual, selecting, lighting, until finally he seats himself again, while from the niche rises the smoke of burnt incense, the smoldering of his mellow, fragrant cigar. Uh-oh, I'm getting some cold breezes from that above-ground sister. I feel I'm about to be edited. Well, all this material about Freud is fascinating, but we're hearing more about him than about H.D. I do have an editorial suggestion. If you're going to give a case example, present it as a case. Tell us H.D.'s presenting problem, her family background, what happened in the analysis. Case study sounds so scientific and linear, but I suppose a case study presented in living language could be poetic. I'll try. When H.D. lays herself down on Freud's couch, she is 47 years old, he is 77. She is entering menopause. She has suffered many losses, a stillborn child, a ruined marriage, lost lovers, a brother killed in the first war, dead parents, her own near death giving birth to a second child. She is in a state of near collapse. She writes, there was something that was beating in my brain. I wanted it to be let out. I wanted to free myself of repetitive thoughts and experiences. But it is not just her personal losses that haunt her. She is haunted by the First World War, when, quote, everybody was waiting for everything to be smashed. Now the same thing is happening again. Again, everyone is waiting for everything to be smashed. It is 1933-34 in Vienna. She is afraid. She feels the collective madness gathering. She has bad dreams. She is a prophet who has not yet found her full voice. Freud says she is resisting the analysis. She is not able to tell him the truth. She has been, quote, leafing over papers in the cafe. There are fresh atrocity stories. I cannot talk about the thing that actually concerns me. I cannot talk to Sigmund Freud in Vienna, 1933, about Jewish atrocities in Berlin. She has Freudian problems stemming from her family of origin. She has Jungian problems. She is stuck in a too narrow definition of herself. The number one and number two aspects of her personality are not communicating. She needs to follow her dreams and her visions to find her way back to her creative source. Freud guides her in both of these realms of analysis. He carries personal and archetypal transferences. In her poem about him, The Master, she describes how he mirrors her, how he tells her she is a poet, and sets her free to prophesy. Her poetry, too, is having a problem. She is known for her clearly faceted, crystalline early poems, the poems on which Ezra Pound, her first lover and initiator into poetry, had based what he called the Imagist school of poetry. Some felt hers was a narrow art. Now her poetry was seeking a bigger voice, tone, subject matter. Listen to her describe her presenting problem in The Master. I did not know how to differentiate between volcanic desire, anemones like embers, and purple fire of violets like red heat and the cold silver of her feet. I had two loves separate. God, who loves all mountains, alone knew why, and told the old man to explain the impossible, which he did. She knew the love of women. She knew the love of men. The eternal forms spoke through her. So did the fragile passing moment, the flower, the seashell. She knew the love of her father, though he was detached, scientific, Athenian in mode. She longed for the love of her mother, whose mode she described as Eleusinian, referring to the ancient feminine mystery religion. She knew the dark god of the underworld and met him in the men she loved, Ezra Pound, to whom she was engaged, until she found out that she was not the only one to whom he had proposed marriage, the poet Richard Aldington, who became her husband but left her for another woman, D.H. Lawrence, who was her deep friend and some say lover, until he suddenly abandoned her. She knew the wisdom of Sappho and the erotic flame between women. She had been referred to Freud, and her bills were paid by her. To know God everywhere. Oh, God, let there be some surprise in heaven for him, for no one but you could devise anything suitable for him so beautiful. Now that's a positive transference. When H.D. lays herself down on Freud's couch, the world of her childhood had been smashed to pieces by the First World War. Her libido was tied up in what she called an old tangle of feelings about the men in her life. H.D. is what we Jungians call an anima woman, a woman on whom men project their... To know God everywhere. Oh, God, let there be some surprise in heaven for him, for no one but you could devise anything suitable for him so beautiful. Now that's a positive transference. When H.D. lays herself down on Freud's couch, the world of her childhood had been smashed to pieces by the First World War. Her libido was tied up in what she called an old tangle of feelings about the men in her life. H.D. is what we Jungians call an anima woman, a woman on whom men project their souls. She was a muse for Ezra Pound, D.H. Lawrence, Richard Aldington, indeed for 20th century poetry and its renewed connection to the gods. She was also brilliant, gifted, and raised in a tradition which gave women direct access to the mysteries. She refused the utter passivity of the anima woman and insisted on her own voice, her own reality, even when it meant fighting Papa Freud. He once showed her his favorite object, a little bronze statue of Pallas Athena. "She is perfect," he said, "only she has lost her spear." H.D. is unimpressed with the goddess's need for a spear or the woman's need for a male member. "I was angry with the old man, with his talk of the male strength. I was angry with his mystery, his mysteries. I argued until daybreak. Oh, what was late, and God will forgive me my anger. But I could not accept it. I could not accept from wisdom what love taught. Woman is perfect." She was not buying into penis envy. Many dead passed before her on that couch in Freud's consulting room. D.H. Lawrence was among them. With Freud's encouragement, she was able to go back to a manuscript describing her relationship to Lawrence and her shattering experiences during the First World War. She learned she was pregnant on the day war was declared. She was convinced her emotional upheaval about the war was the cause of the stillbirth of her child. She was near a breakdown. No one understood her feeling. Not Aldington, not Pound, only D.H. Lawrence did. Something flared between those two. Inspiration, longing, desire, a great battle of projections, then disappointment, abandonment, a fight. In one of her strongest early poems, Eurydice, H.D. rages at Lawrence, her Orpheus. "So for your arrogance and your ruthlessness, I have lost the earth and the flowers of the earth and the live souls above the earth. This is the rage of the Anima woman who has found her own voice, who understands the nature of what's being projected on her. She writes, "What was it you saw in my face? The light of your own face? The fire of your own presence?" Lawrence had said to her, "Stick to the woman speaking. How can you know what Orpheus feels? It's your part to be the woman vibration. Eurydice should be enough." This from the creator of Lady Chatterley, of Women in Love, who felt entirely free to speak for the woman. Lawrence had taken her psyche by storm, a difficult and demanding animus. He had pulled away from her abruptly after the First World War. It's unclear why. She never saw him again. His death of tuberculosis in 1930 left her spiritually abandoned until she met Freud. To HD, and this is a beautiful example of transference, Freud looked like Lawrence, smiled like Lawrence. So Freud carried a Lawrence transference as well as father and mother transferences. Seeing Lawrence in Freud enabled her to temper what Jungians call her negative animus, her internalized male critic. She could love Freud and fight with him for her own point of view. Woman is perfect. The goddess does not require a spear or a penis. She writes in The Master, "She is woman. Her thighs are frail yet strong. She leaps from rock to rock. It was only a small circle for her dance. And the hills dance. She conjures the hills, rhododendrons awake. Her feet pulse, the rhododendrons wake. There is purple flower between her marble, her birch tree, white thighs, or there is a red flower. There is a rose flower parted wide as her limbs fling wide in dance, ecstatic Aphrodite. There is a frail lavender flower hidden in grass. Oh God, what is it, this flower, that in itself has power over the whole world? For she needs no man. Herself is that dart and pulse of the male, hands, feet, thighs, herself, perfect." With Freud, she remembers the journey that she and her companion Breyer had taken by ship in Greece, where she had a fearful vision of a dim shape forming, of light, not shadow, in the shape of a head of an airman. And this is mysterious. It's hard to tell why this was so fearful and frightening to her, but it was. And Freud entered with her into this vision. It was followed... The outline of the head of the airman was followed by another shadow cast in light. It was the shape of a tripod, the kind that one would use to support a small saucepan, but it was also, she writes, none other than our old friend, the tripod of classic Delphi, venerated object of the cult of the sun god, symbol of poetry and prophecy. This vision came to her as a young woman and terrified her with the power of the prophecy that she was to carry. She'd struggled early to find words to express it, not very well. In tribute to Freud, one can feel her ability to do this clarifying. She's beginning to be able to articulate this powerful archetypal experience. It's not so much, I think, that Freud understood it, but that he went into it with her, that he helped hold her while she was explaining to him what it was. It's a vision which is like Jung describing a tremendous intuition, a whirlwind that seizes everything within reach. The tripod also appears in Goethe's Faust when Faust makes his descent to the realm of the mothers, and I think it appears to H.D. because she has been in such a descent. The images she saw when she and Breyer were in the hotel in Corfu will follow her whole life, and she translates them after her analysis to Freud into her most powerful poetry. I think that Freud makes this possible by understanding her calling, seeing who she really is. She describes this in The Master. "It was he himself, he who set me free to prophesy. He did not say, 'Stay, my disciple.' He did not say, 'Write, each word I say is sacred.' No, he was rather casual. 'We won't argue about that,' he said. 'You are a poet.'" During her analysis with Freud, H.D. had a dream. In it, an Egyptian princess wearing a saffron-colored robe descends a long staircase to a river. I, the dreamer, wait at the foot of the steps. There in the water beside me is a shallow basket. There is, of course, a baby nested in it. The princess must find the baby. I know that the baby will be protected and sheltered by her, and that is all that matters. Freud wonders, is she the baby in the dream? Does H.D. harbor an unconscious wish to be the founder of a new religion? On the contrary, H.D. thinks that it is Freud who is the baby, Freud who is the new Moses. In her notes, she quotes a friend who says, just as we're all getting over this Jesus Christ business, trust another Jew to come along and upset our calculations. She sees Freud as being the founder of a new religion, as being the Moses of the new religion of psychology. She worries about Freud's lack of religious feeling. He is an old man. What of the immortality of his soul? It worries her that religion, art, and medicine have been separated in the latter ages. She believes that the tripod of Delphi, which she saw on the wall in Corfu, symbolizes the three working together, forming a new vehicle of expression. Certainly, her work with Freud has given her a new vehicle of expression. Through her transference connection to him, she has done reparative work on her personal parents. She has shared an altered state of consciousness with him, a remembering of a fearful vision that has been transformed into a cradle for the baby Moses. From an archetypal perspective, H.D.'s dream of the baby Moses foreshadows the prophecy which Freud freed her to experience and to express. It is significant that she sees Freud as the baby Moses. He will be protected and raised by the Egyptian princess in the robes of a priestess. This Jewish prophet of a new science returns to the ancient Egyptian layer of the psyche in H.D.'s dream. He who has been both father and mother to her will be born again to be raised in a temple of Isis in the precinct of the ancient feminine mysteries. Listen to her prophecy in the great poem Tribute to the Angels, which is the middle section of Trilogy, in which she wrote some years after her analysis with Freud. We have seen her the world over, Our Lady of the Goldfinch, Our Lady of the Candelabra, Our Lady of the Pomegranate, Our Lady of the Chair. Her veils were white as snow. She looked beautiful. She looked lovely. She was clothed with a garment down to the foot, but it was not girt about with a golden girdle. She bore none of her usual attributes. The child was not with her. She carries a book, but it is not the tome of the ancient wisdom. The pages, I imagine, are the blank pages of the unwritten volume of the new. She is not shut up in a cave like a sibyl. She is not imprisoned in leaden walls in a color window. She is Psyche, the butterfly, out of the cocoon. Poetry puts its ear to the ground to hear the deepest beat of time, mythic time, millennial time, God's time. H.D. is telling us about the birth of the new psychological attitude that combines religion, science, and art, and is based in the feminine. But what does all this have to do with the ordinary soul in analysis? We aren't all great poets like H.D. True, but we are all seeking our own voices, our own deepest language, how our personal myth fits into the greater changing myth. In finding a language for her own soul, H.D. began to find a language for the soul of our terrible century. Her prophecy joins the work of Freud and Jung and gives us images to see the emergence of the deep feminine. Women especially have been looking for a language in which to tell our deepest stories, our body stories, our soul stories. H.D. was one of the first to find her tongue, a tongue from the feminine depths. I think your recent poem, Lady, is in this tradition. How about reading it as a way to end this talk? Wait a minute, you want me to read my own work in the context of discussing H.D. and Freud? Doesn't that strike you as a bit presumptuous? Now that I've got you seriously writing poetry, it's not enough for you to quote others. I want you to put your own poetry in your talks as well. Aren't you a good example of how analysis can help a woman find the language of her soul? And didn't you have a dream in which a voice told you that H.D. was your grandmother? In all the interesting dreams you had about Jung, he was never a relative. And isn't your poem about the work of staying in touch with the soul, which is what this talk is all about? And doesn't the poem begin with an epigram from H.D., from the very poem you just discussed? All right. You've convinced me. So this is my poem, which I'll end with. And it's called Lady, and it begins with an epigram from H.D. We have seen her the world over. Our Lady of the Goldfinch, Our Lady of the Candelabra, Our Lady of the Pomegranate, Our Lady of the Chair. Where did you go, my Lady of the Searing Light, after the ground opened, after the thunder clapped, after you made me be a crawling creature of your belly? Where did you go, Joy Lady, after you painted intricate designs upon the soles of my feet? Jaipur dancer, gopi milkmaid, stamping love of Krishna's wild blue fluting in my flesh. Red Lady, Guadalupe of the clay, you live upon my altar, wear a purple shawl with fringe. Turtle knows you, so does the owl. When did I forget? Were you swallowed by the black snake? Are you being absorbed backwards into another time? Are you a creature of the dark, the raw and the throbbing, the muscle that remembers, the bone that breaks? Were you pulled too violently into the light? Was it you, Lady of the underside, who turned me upside down and shook the contents of my guts out? Was it you, Lady of the second half, who ripped my old skin off and left me new and tender, a foundling in a bone basket? You are the bread that is needed. You are the burning. You are the bird song. You are the lost gold ring set with 7 small rubies. You are the last summer fruits. You are the meteor showers reeling in the hot night. I wake to your voice in my ears. I wake to your laughing in my holiest place. Where have you been that you come back with salt on your lips? Lady, you are sea green to my blue song. You fling the whole ocean out of your hair. You speak in all the tongues. Lady, were you written into the palms of my hands, into the constellations of my stars? Did you show me the cracked kernel at the innermost core of the word, where it says its beginning, where it says its end? Lady, I have feared you. When I was young, you cracked me open, tore the purple flower out of my chest, spit my seeds to the four winds. Lady of hyacinth, of blood that stops flowing, there is a broken promise between us. I said I'd spend my life with you. I lost you at the airport. They interrupted holy night to page. You fell into the great rift. I hear the screaming oak cut down. We live on scorched earth. Only the tax collector knows the value of the hours, the weight of the bags. How many camels will it take to bring the lady back? You come to me out of the darkness of a cave painting, out of the bottom of a breath, out of a dream. You tell me this is the way it happens. Every day I lose you. Every day I find you. Somewhere wandering. Beside the asphalt road, 7 naked ladies appear under the cherry tree in the black lace ecstasy of night. In the trailing veil, over the face of the moon, in the glowing fringe of dawn, thrown over the dancing shoulders of the hills, your eyes meet mine. Thank you. Well, I thought we could take a break, or I could take a break, and then we can, I'd be glad to talk to you all after, you know, 10-minute break or so, and I have some things I'd like to share with you. Things I want to let you all know. One is there's still a few magazines. I'm doing a commercial for for the magazines that I'm associated with and that I love. As Karen mentioned, I'm poetry and fiction editor of Psychological Perspectives, and they published an essay of mine in 1990, I think, that ended up being the beginning of my book, and they've just kept publishing me ever since. And it's a wonderfully eclectic magazine that has in it science and art. We have a new managing editor who's from the art world, and she, with each issue, she finds a new artist to do this incredible artwork, and you'll see that the art continues all through all the pages. This is the new one, which doesn't have anything of mine in it, but I wanted you to see it. And this is one that has some of the material in the talk I gave today is in the Poetry of Soul, and some of it is not. Some of it goes off in a different direction. These are a series of what I call acts of imagination, these talks, and they involve these kinds of confrontation with ancient parts of my psyche. So one of the ancient parts of my psyche that showed up was the ancient Naomi from the Old Testament. And so that's what this one is about. And I'm also associated with the San Francisco Jung Institute Library Journal, which is a review journal. And I had a long review article about HD's work, much of which, if you read it, is in the talk you heard today. So that's available for $10 if you want to write a check to the Jung Institute, or the Psych Perspectives are $15. We have these beautiful bookmarks. You can take them home and keep them and send off your subscriptions to Psych Perspectives. So that's the ad for Psych Perspectives. I do an ad for Crab Creek Review, which was good enough to publish a poem of mine. You know, and this poet of mine who's making me be serious about poetry, what I think is that it's taken me 27 years of analysis to be able to be a poet who can tolerate rejections. When I was first writing poetry, I just crumbled under rejections. I could not stand and you get your work rejected all the time. And occasionally you get an acceptance. And this is a lovely magazine that actually accepted me. So they're here around. And anybody who's interested in poetry, I recommend it. And the other thing is I wanted to say a little bit about the workshop tomorrow, and then we can just talk about the talk, or I can answer any questions you have. It's a writing workshop, and it's called Writing from the Depths. And what I'm hoping to do is to help whoever of you wants to come to invoke the poet in you or the prose writer, doesn't have to be poetry, who can write from places, the kind of places that HD and Freud hung out in together, the early childhood places, to find those images and those landscapes and those words, I think of them as mana words, magic words that pull up for us entire sets of feelings and emotions from childhood. And we'll just be doing free writing, and people will be, you know, you can share your work if you want to. You don't have to share it if you don't want to. I find when I do these workshops that there's something very powerful about the group working together, and people's voices are just astounding. I'll be bringing in a bunch of poetry and other writings to kind of get us going, get us thinking, including writing by Jung, who wrote quite a bit about his childhood and memories, dreams, and reflections. So I think it'll be a fun half day, and hopefully I'll see some of you there. So I'm certainly interested to hear any of your responses to the fight that happened before your eyes, the struggle between the parts of my psyche and the story about HD and Freud. And yes. What an anima woman is? Well, an anima woman is the kind of woman who, by her beauty and her intelligence, kind of inspires a projection from men that, oh, God. Well, and it's not only men. You know, I was saying recently to a lesbian woman in my practice that I think she's an anima woman. I mean, women just fall in love with her. They took one look at her and whoop, you know. And it's not, the thing that's so awful about being an anima woman, you know, it's wonderfully flattering to have people, you know, keeling over, falling in love with you right and left, but it's not about you. It's about the projection on you. I have a very beautiful daughter. All my daughters are beautiful, but this daughter is my adopted Indian daughter, who's particularly beautiful in just this incredible way. And my husband Dan remembers this story. Was it you or was it me who was driving down the street one day and Shanti was walking on the street and I literally saw a young man walk into a lamppost looking at her. Shanti is an anima woman. It's been really hard for her, you know. I mean, that's what I mean. I think HD had that, you know, quality. And but she also developed the capacity to really find her own voice. The danger for an anima woman is that she's just being is the reflection of the projections on her, and that she's always, you know, responding to people in terms of what the projection is, and that it's so hard for her to find her own voice and her own reality and her own authenticity. So when HD says in that raging poem to called Eurydice, which is written to D.H. Lawrence, you know, what is it that you see in my face, your own reflection? She's exactly saying the psychological truth of what the anima woman experiences. Yes. Well, you know, I'm going to make a little bit of a subtle distinction here. For me, my number one is the ego, not my animus, but my ego, meaning that she's the part of me, and it took me a long time to develop this because I, as a young woman, I was kind of, I don't know, spacey and poetic and couldn't be bothered with details like paying bills, and it's still hard for me to be bothered with details like paying bills. So developing an ego that could really take care of business and develop a profession and, you know, tend to the concrete realities of life, that was a big achievement of the earlier part of my psychological work. And I don't experience that part of me as being so critical. I experience a part of being suspicious of the number two part that really doesn't care about nitty-gritty everyday realities. Now, the animus is something else. When the animus comes in, he can be a bastard or he can be very supportive, and he can come in and be very critical and undercutting of the creative process of the soul. But that's a whole other paper. The fight here for me is between ego and self, and in my own particular psychology, it took me a long time to get an ego that could make a living, you know, and take care of business. And then that ego kind of said, I'm not going to let that number two come in and take over again, because you know what happens when she takes over. Everything becomes chaotic and messy, and you know, you're not able to pay the mortgage. But it's to be that playful with it, I mean, it really took me a very long time, I think, to be. And what I think that Jung says, that active imagination is one of the most powerful vehicles for psychological work, and one that you have to have done a lot of work before you can get to it. You have to have worked with your shadow a lot and worked with ego and self a lot. And for me, the playfulness is in the active imagination, where you can actually let those different, where I can let those parts of myself speak to me. When I got it, that I could do that, it just took the lid off something. Yes. Well, thank you. Well, I mean, this is the part where my number one was being pretty critical of my number two part, because, you know, when you're actually in the therapy process, the point is not to make a work of art. The point is to help the patient have access to her own or his own deepest voice. So that aesthetic thing about beauty isn't the issue. It's more about authenticity and depth. And I find that having a poetic consciousness, if a patient says something to me that includes a metaphor, like I'm feeling trapped, what the poet in me has taught me to do is to go with the metaphor and to say, well, how are you feeling trapped? What are you trapped in? And to get down into that real metaphor. So the issue there isn't the beauty of it, but is to take the language seriously, to get the life going in it, and to get down to, and pretty soon, you know, the person is often able to use his or her imagination and say, well, I feel trapped, and give an actual picture of a place that they feel trapped in and what it would take to open the door to that. So we enter a kind of imaginal world together. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I find that when something really starts happening between me and a patient where we're both in the same metaphor and we're working it together, it becomes beautiful and moving. That's generally my experience. And, of course, it doesn't always happen. It's grace when it happens, you know. But to bring that, or it's grace when a poem happens, too. But to bring that consciousness of language to it. I hear so many people say, talk about language as though it's some kind of other thing that's too bad we have to use words. And it always makes me cringe because I think words are so sacred. But when we use jargon, even Jungian jargon, the words lose their sacredness and become they lose their aliveness. Anything else? You know, I was quoting from Donald Hall, and that was his language describing the baby. And it's in a series of essays he wrote called Death to the Death of Poetry. Right, put out by Michigan Press. If you hold on a second, I'll get the reference. But I can read it again if you want to hear it again. Is that what you're asking? Crib pleasure. If crib pleasure does not endure, there will be no poetry. Right. Isn't that lovely? Of the baby. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. When you think of it that way, go ahead. Yes, yes, exactly. That's a beautiful essay. Thank you for reminding me of it. That's just a gorgeous essay.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU and Society, Seattle. And the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.